This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I referred to Brandon as the Jon Snow of Ed Reform. Not even sure what I meant by that.
Okay.
I'm not sure what he does on the actual show.
He does, Game of Thrones. All the characters do. He dies.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Robert Pundicio of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Jon Snow of Ed Reform, Brandon Wright.
So that's from Game of Thrones, which I don't watch.
You know, I don't watch it either, but there's only one thing I know about Game of Thrones. Maybe there's really only one thing that you
tons
need
to know. Tons of
people
die on it?
Everyone. It's like Shakespeare.
It's supposed to be very, very violent.
Right. There's two types of characters, those who have been killed and those who will be killed. Mm-hmm. At least I gather that. Mm-hmm. My daughter made me watch this one scene of this guy, God, literally ripping a guy's head apart with his bare hands. Like, that was all I needed to see of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I've heard about that scene, and my wife doesn't really like violence that's that graphic.
It's
so
not
we
beneath
haven't
my
watched
dignity.
It, and it would just be a big lift to start watching it by myself in the small amount of free time I have without my wife or without being at work.
Maybe you and me will, after the podcast, maybe we'll start binge watching it on Netflix. What do you say?
Isn't it like seven seasons in?
I don't know, but it's seven seasons I'm not going to watch.
Is that like 300 hours of shows?
We got time. Let's do this.
All right.
Okay, that's all the time we have for the podcast. Okay, here we go. Time to play Pardon the Gadfly. Take it away, Dominique.
Question one. The New York Times published an article on Saturday that argued against legislation that would effectively prevent research from using student data. Thoughts?
Oh, thoughts. The Luddites have taken over. that was the same era. No, that was after Game of Thrones, the Luddites. They're the ones who destroyed all the machinery. What do you think? I shouldn't make fun. I mean, there's legitimate reasons, but you first, Brandon. What do you think of this?
So like anything, I think there are pros and cons, right? So we have to see what the benefits are of keeping this information and providing it to people who actually want to use it in a legitimate way to improve education.
To use their powers for good, not evil.
Right. So I think that there are great benefits to using this information in a legitimate and safe way.
Sure.
And let me underline the word safe, because the other part of it, right, to kind of minimize the cons, that is the kind of infringement on privacy, mm-hmm. you have to provide certain protections for this information. So the article in the New York Times talks about how this researcher, everything that she's done, the data is on a secure server and there is no identifying information at all. And if a researcher were to kind of break these rules, there are both potential civil and criminal
what you're saying, and the writer of the piece in the Times, by the way, was from your alma mater, Susan Dynarski of the University of Michigan.
Go blue.
There you go. Now, you're making the argument, I guess, that she was making that there should be strong protections to keep sensitive data private.
Sure.
But here's my question. Do we already have that? And if not, where is all this angst about student data coming from?
I mean, I think there are protections there, but I think kind of online security is an ever-evolving kind of battle.
And
right?
It is. And look, every time I think if people are nervous about this, they come by it honestly. If you think about it, every time we hear about data privacy in the news, it's bad news. It's WikiLeaks,
sure.
It's the NSA, it's hackers, it's credit card fraud. So I'm deeply concerned that these kinds of measures could cost researchers the access that they need to valuable data to move the field forward, I can't sit here and pretend I'm surprised at the level of parental anxiety about this. I mean, every time you hear about data being stored, like Game of Thrones, this ends badly.
Sure, but what we're talking about now are people who are breaking laws.
Sure.
And what the author is arguing against are laws that will make it more difficult for a researcher to use this information to better education, right?
Impossible.
So they are following laws. What we're concerned about are people breaking laws. So more laws don't really seem to solve that problem. So you essentially have two options. You have one, which is where you don't store information at all. And I think that's unrealistic. And I'm not sure it's wise, or you do your best to protect it and create rules so that the people who do use it use it in a smart and productive way. And I think that's, you know, essentially where we're at. And we should, you know, continue to better those. We should continue to secure it right. as that technology.
Yeah, but I don't think
advancements in security.
Agreed. I don't think you can not be concerned about this. I mean, sure. data and testing, the data from testing, it is to education research what rocks are to geologists, you know, what tissue samples are to biologists. If we don't have that, we do not move forward.
Sure.
But that said, I would hope that we would, I think those of us who are in the reform game, as it were, owe it to parents to be more explicit and clear about how uses of these data benefit all kids, including theirs. It just won't do to just say, you know, get over it.
Agreed.
Dominique, question two.
Jeb Bush announced yesterday that he's running for president. How does he measure up to other candidates on education?
You know, I kind of thought we already knew he was running, right? It feels like it's been
yeah.
This is not big news. It's not
it's
a surprise.
His formal announcement.
There you go. It's his formal announcement. Well, Brandon, you have been doing incredible due diligence, going back, pouring over the published statements of every candidate as they announce. Jeb Bush being the least. I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, that of all the candidates you've examined, his track record has got to be the deepest and widest on education.
Yeah. I mean, when he was at the helm of Florida, he instituted a bunch of ed reforms, things like school choice and standards, tax scholarships. And then when he left, he founded one of the most influential ed reform nonprofits out there, the Foundation for Excellence in Education. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he's been doing this stuff for a very long time.
So if you're an education reform voter, he's your guy.
I guess it depends on whether you agree with his ideas, right? I mean, if you like the Common Core and you're Republican, then he's essentially the only choice if that's a deciding issue for you. If you don't, then it seems like one of the other, I think there are now 12 with Trump having announced.
Only 12?
12 Republicans in the race. So it seems like if you were very, very against Common Core, then you would go with one of the other 11.
Hmm. So it's Jeb against the field. And if Common Core is your issue, then you're going with the field. But I guess my question is to what degree Common Core will be an issue. I mean, 2016 is still a very long way away.
Yeah, I mean, I would be surprised if Common Core were the deciding issue in the presidential race.
Well, look, education is never the deciding issue in the race, is it? I mean, we it's our issue, but come on.
I'm not that old, so I haven't been through that many elections. So you might be a better judge of that.
I saw what you did there, Brandon.
But I'll trust you. I'll trust you. I mean, obviously, the race itself will end up deciding what the biggest issue is. And I guess it's possible that it's the Common Core, but probably not.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. Again, you know, I would love if we would have this great deep national debate and education was the defining issue and the deciding issue in 2016. I think it'll be a lot more discussed in the primaries than the general. But I would be very, very surprised if Common Core at the end of the day either helped him or hurt him. I think there's a lot of other things that voters are concerned about. It'd be great if our issue was theirs, but there's a lot of stuff going on.
I think you're right.
There you go. Question three, Dominique.
This one's for you, Robert. You wrote an editorial last week in which you called on districts to publicly release their information about their curricula. Why should districts comply?
Boy, this is kind of a piece with the data story we were talking about earlier, right? Look, this to me is just an enduring mystery. I mean, if you think about it, in our test-driven, accountability-mad, data-focused age, you know, we measure everything about schools. We can tell you where teachers went to ed school. We can tell you their SAT scores before they got in. We can tell you the value-added scores of their, you know, their 25 fourth graders in any school. So here's my question. How come it's impossible, and I mean almost literally impossible, to find out what curricula a school is using to teach, say, math or English language arts? This strikes me as being not a difficult thing to find out, mm-hmm. a deeply important thing to know. I always like to point out the report by Russ Whitehurst and Matt Chingos over at Brookings a few years ago that discovered that effect sizes of curriculum were even bigger than some of the things that we obsess over in ed reform, things like class size and teacher quality and chartering and whatnot. So if we know curriculum is so important and could be potentially so important in moving the needle, why are we not mandating that districts report this what curriculum they're using? This is my challenge to parents all the time. Do you know what math curriculum your school is using? I'll bet you don't. The difference that a parent has over a researcher, a benefit, is that the parent wants to know, they can just look in their kid's backpack. If you're a researcher, good luck trying to find out what the curriculum is in a school. And this issue became an issue last week when Charles Somm of the Manhattan Institute released a report. He had a very simple research question. He wanted to find out what curricula New York City schools were using to implement Common Core. There had been two different recommendations on ELA curricula. This is going back to the Bloomberg era. And the only way he could find out was not by looking up on the state or city website. He had to send a questionnaire electronically to every single school in New York City. That's lunacy.
Yeah. It seems totally absurd. So to better define this for people who aren't in education all the time, what exactly do you mean by curriculum?
I should not take for granted that people understand the difference. We talk about standards all the time, and I'm always the guy who says, well, look, standards are important, but standards are important insofar as they influence curriculum choices.
And people confuse the two often.
Absolutely. They completely conflate the two. So, for example, when I was a teacher in the South Bronx, our math curriculum was everyday math. Our literacy curriculum was teachers, college, reading, and writing projects.
These are actually brands, essentially?
Call them brands, I guess. You were call them products, call them programs. Another reason this is important is from an accountability standpoint. Now, I full disclosure, I've never made a secret about this. I couldn't stand either of those programs, the math or the literacy program, but this was what I was compelled to teach. Now, if you look at the results that I posted with my students, is it me as the teacher? Or is it the curriculum? The thing that frustrates me and has frustrated me for years is we just seem, those of us in education reform, absolutely incurious about this. Like all that matters is the teacher. It doesn't matter what program. Let me tell you, having taught these programs for a couple of years, I would not want my performance evaluated on the strength of those curriculum. Give me a choice. I'm going to choose something different.
So why do you think schools haven't made this information more public or public, period?
I simply think I could be just wrong and naive about this. I think it's just simply a blind spot. I think mainstream ed reform thinking is that it's the teacher, it's the governance model, curriculum is an afterthought. I just don't think we in education or the field, we're just not that savvy consumers about these things.
All right. And final point, how do you think we can change this?
Morgan Polakoff of the University of Southern California has been filing Freedom of Information Act requests in four states, trying to get the
over curriculum. 3,000, right?
3,000 of them in four states. He raises the point, and I completely agree with. We already have any number of data capturing mechanisms. Why not just mandate at a state level that schools have to report this in existing mechanisms that they're almost certainly already performing?
Okay, good.
So that's that.
Cool.
And that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Next, here's Amber with the Research Minute. Hey, Amber, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Let me ask you a question. Does the name Jon Snow mean anything to you?
Jon Snow. Oh, no. I feel like I'm failing a quiz.
No, it does not. Okay. I referred to Brandon as the Jon Snow of ed reform. Not even sure what I meant by that.
Okay.
I'm not sure what he does on the actual show.
He does.
Game of Thrones.
All the characters do. He dies.
Oh, he died.
He dies.
And
he died.
Every other character on that show.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow. Like, and how do you guys know this if you don't watch it?
It's all over the news.
You know what?
Twitter
it's like
and
the most
stuff.
Talked about show in the world.
Exactly. I describe this as the cultural equivalent of secondhand smoke. It just, you pick it up. You don't have to be.
And you don't really want to sometimes. And it's dangerous for you. We keep carrying this metaphor, I guess.
Having seen the way people die on Game of Thrones, no, I would not wish that upon least of all Brandon.
And is that good for kids? Is that one of these video games?
I'm not sure it's a kid's show.
damaging.
It's definitely not, a kid
not a kid show.
It is a very, very adult show.
It has one of those stickers on the front when you buy it.
Like, perhaps the most adult show that's on popular television.
Oh, all right.
It's on HBO. Right.
But I'm Brandon and I are going to binge watch right after the podcast. Please join us.
We'll for not 300 be doing hours. That, but anyhow.
So Amber, what you got for us this week?
We've got a new NBER study called Mothers, Employment, and Children's Educational Gender Gap. All right. I know it sounds thrilling, but it's actually interesting. It examines the impact of women's participation in the workforce on their child's college attainment. Okay. Analysts use data from the Norway registry. All right. So it's not here, which includes information on all children born in Norway between 1967 and 1993. So that's about roughly 725,000 males and 690,000 females. So that's a lot of kids. Then they match the child's data with data from their parents, which describes, among other things, their parents' earnings history when their children were birthed and up to age 17. So 0 to 17. Descriptive data show that the employment of mothers with young children, this is interesting, has increased from 10% in 1967 to what do you think in 1993? Now you get a quiz.
Great question. I'm going to guess 40%.
Brandon, you got an answer? Oh, don't be looking. 65% in 1993.
In basically a generation.
That's pretty big deal, isn't
that
it?
That really is.
Father's employment has remained fairly constant, around 93%, which seemed kind of high to me. But
hardworking country, Norway.
Controlling for various family and child demographics, they find that the mother's employment has a positive impact on their daughter's college attainment relative to the effect on the sons. Specifically, daughters are more likely than sons to have a college or higher degree by the age of 25. Mothers with more female children are also more likely to be in the workplace. After controlling for the total number of children, lots to think about. I'm almost done. Interestingly, the father's employment also has a negative effect on boys' college attainment and a positive effect for the girls.
But hold on a second. This makes, on the one hand, sense. On the other hand, am I wrong about this? If moms have gone, their workforce participation has gone from 10% to 65%, you're just seeing a society in general that is transitioning from a defined, the man works, the woman stays at home, to a two-paycheck family, which implies, does it not, a greater need for education. So this has nothing to do with the moms. This has to do with a cultural shift where women are entering the workforce.
Well,
in huge numbers, right?
I mean, I think that one could propose that, but this is an NBER study that was fairly rigorous and controlled for about a gazillion different things. But let me tell you one thing that they hypothesize, which is similar to what you hypothesize. But so increased time with a son already resulted in higher marginal gains for him. So he already benefits from more time with a mom. Okay. So it makes sense that if you decrease that time, it's going to have a higher consequence for him as well.
Sure.
All right. And then for the daughter, the analysts reason that a working mother provides a working role model, which may have increased her expected return from schooling. So she's kind of seeing this, man, I can do this too. This is the kind of the direction that I'd like to head. Anyway, that's the theory. And so then they ended up with a sort of long discussion of how all of these sort of patterns help to explain the narrowing and the reversal of the education gender gap since the 1950s. Which is basically the difference in a college attainment between the males and the females. So, I mean, I think this is both encouraging and troubling, right, at the same time, because obviously we don't really know exactly what's happening here, even though they try to control for these many, many things. And I think that it's a head scratcher, right? So why, I mean, we all have theories, right? Like, why would the impact on the among the daughters?
Right.
Be more than the kids. I mean, and the son. I mean, I think they draw a reasonable assumption that boys automatically, you know, benefit from the increased time, so they're going to lose out more. But why is that? I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids, so I can't even.
It does
begin.
Definitely seem like a son has a different relationship with his father than his mom, and a daughter has a different one between her two parents too. And same with. A parent, right? A mother has a different relationship with her daughter than her son. And obviously this is anecdotal. I don't know that many parents, but it just kind of seems to be the case. So I don't know exactly why that is.
Right? I still smell a cultural shift as much as mm-hmm. an educational one, but that's sure. just one man's opinion.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, what they say is, like, let's bear this theory out, right? Mm-hmm. So now that it's pretty much stabilized the women's participation rates in the workplace. So I think what we're going to see in the next 25 years is, if this is the right theory, right, then we're not going to see the changes that we've witnessed right. so far, because that stabilized and the other changes stabilized. So yeah, I mean, I think we obviously, this is a favorite topic. You know, we've got a lot of studies that are really intrigued by the impact of the change in women's participation in the workforce since the 50s. So right.
we'll stay tuned. We'll see you back here in 20 years, and we'll have answers to those
right.
questions. Okay. Hey, Amber, before we let you go, and I'm going to completely put you on the spot.
Uh-oh.
Did you see Susan Dynarski's op-ed in the New York Times about education data, and how, as a research person, how concerned are you?
I'd have not read it, but obviously I've been immersed in the question, and I think that we could easily go overboard. And I'm scared that if we aren't careful, we're going to go overboard. And I think
overboard
there are some fear mongering about yeah. how these data are used that are probably untrue, and they may be being espoused by folks who have ulterior motives.
So overboard on the protection of the data?
Right. Okay.
Protecting it so much that you can't gather it anymore.
Right. And I think we already, like, what people don't realize is we already have some pretty tight protocols in place, you know, for making sure these data are secure. It's not like, I mean, I think the average, you know, parent might not understand that you don't get information on Sally Joe's, you know, fourth right. grade, you know, you get student ID number 1188652.
Yep.
That is exactly what the article says.
Exactly. You're echoing my point, which is that I don't think it'll do for those of us who need this data to complain about it. We just need to do a better job of explaining it.
Yes. Agreed.
Right. And that is all the time we have for this week's Gadfly Show. Till next week.
I'm Brandon Rutter.
And I'm Robert Pundicio for the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.